I'm Nell Frizzell, and this is The Panic Years. When I was 28, everyone around me seemed to be getting married, getting promotions, buying houses, and having babies. I was single, redundant, and living with my mum. At the time, I thought it was a private crisis. Now I understand it was just my panic years, and that is what this podcast is all about. I am sitting by the river, about to go for my morning swim. It's been a hell of a week. The panic years came out on Thursday. My big orange memoir is finally out and about, and you can read it. To celebrate, I walked around town with my dad, carrying a big banner that said I wrote a book, and went and saw it in a shop window. Ate some noodles on a wall, just got incredibly overexcited. If you've already bought the book, thank you. I love you. Talking of the panic years, my guest this week is the comedian, author, broadcaster, and all-round genius, Sarah Pascoe. I've been a fan and admirer of Sarah for years. My God, she's good. Her books, Animal and Sex, Power, Money, genuinely changed the way I think about the world. And her recent sitcom, Out of Her Mind, is probably my favourite TV comedy from the last decade. It's just phenomenal. If you haven't seen it, sort that out immediately. I also knew I wanted to talk to Sarah for this podcast because she's always just written and talked so brilliantly and thought so deeply about all of this stuff. Love, relationships, family, commitment, babies, marriage, breakups, fertility, bodies, all of it. But after watching Out of Her Mind, I knew I had to talk to her about weddings in particular, specifically why people like me and her find them so awful, why people keep having them, what they mean, how we react when our friends start doing it. She was absolutely brilliant. The chat is great. Also, please stick around after the interview because I'll be talking in a little bit more detail to an expert guest. Okay, see you soon. How are you and how is your body?
Oh, that's a lovely question. I think I'm fine. I am currently day two of my period. And so I don't know how yours is.
I'm on day one.
Are you day one? Okay. So day one's my worst day. And right. Day two is like, okay, you're here. But also I do need to be a little bit nicer to myself. I have a heat mat that I lie on when I'm in the house. It's so soothing and you can sleep on it.
Is that like a sort of mixed grill scenario?
Yeah, it's made by George Foreman. Smells delicious, actually.
First day of my period, it's quite a relief not to feel hideously unattractive anymore, which is what had been sort of happening in the previous 2 days.
Yeah, it does. It really puts you inside yourself. When I was a teenager, I used to think that when I very first started my period, I used to feel like I had no skin. Like suddenly that all of my emotions were so on the surface and everyone could see everything and I couldn't hide anything. It's a very visceral time.
I love, one of my favourite things is to try and explain what it feels like to someone who doesn't menstruate.
Yeah.
To actually recreate the experience. So I'm going to just lightly spray you in sunflower oil and put you in some slightly too small clothes and make it a little bit warm and sort of unseen. I'll give you a little bit of an ear infection. If you could like create it all.
Yeah. I would start with the basis of a really bad hangover because I think, you know, when you're really hungover and so it's not really your emotion, but you're feeling them. So like you're crying for no reason.
Yeah.
Like you start with that and you want to eat things that you think are going to make you feel better, but then they make you hate yourself because it's an altered state. And intellectually, you know, it's because you drank. Like intellectually, you know, it's your hormones because you're about to start a new cycle, but it doesn't help. Like knowing that you're hungover and why it's happened doesn't make it go away.
I wanted to talk to you for this because I loved Out of Her Mind. I thought it was just the most phenomenal thing I'd ever seen. And it touched on something that is really key for me to the panic years, which is I was incredibly ambivalent about weddings.
Oh.
In all sorts of ways. I've been to both of my dad's weddings and I'm the product of my mum's second wedding. I'm like the ghost of weddings past that proves that these things aren't going to work.
You haunt them. The person they shouldn't really have there. But
I'm sort of this horrible spectre of the fact that maybe weddings don't lead to everlasting marriages. Yeah. Which I used to think that was the problem, that I was just very caught up in the fact that I didn't believe necessarily in one forever love. But now I think it might just be that I was sad that I hadn't met anyone that I wanted to marry.
I think it can be a confusing mixture of everything. It can be much more than one thing, you know, because the vast majority of people have bought into, you know, eternal love, meeting the one, and obviously weddings as a huge symbol of that. Even if day to day you disagree, when you are like, you feel like the only person in the room kind of going, those vows, eh? A bit full on. But another part of you can't help but absorb, these people look at me and think I've failed at this, or I've done something wrong, or I'm broken. Or the idea that you don't feel it.
Yes.
Oh, it must be because I'm the broken one then.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think it's really hard not to feel, and this happens all through my 20s and 30s, and it will no doubt carry on. Other people's life decisions are a judgment on my life. And a wedding can really feel like this is a sort of public display of Nell's failure, even though I'm such a peripheral part in every wedding, including my dad's wedding. I felt really like I was not of the family at that wedding because I was of a previous family. And that was kind of weird. And I loved how in your sitcom, the dad and the mum are both like operating in this simultaneous presence and past and future relationships, and how they all sit really uncomfortably alongside each other. Is that one of the reasons why weddings are weird? Because we don't like having all these disparate groups of people around each other?
I think what you describe is really astute about why they're weird. It's because we place ourselves into something we shouldn't be at, actually. I think the trouble with the human ego is that wherever we are the main character. And then at a wedding, you are absolutely, most usually, a guest. Like, you're not one of the people getting married. So 99% of the time, guest at a wedding. And I don't think our egos can handle it. Maybe it's that. Maybe it doesn't matter who's getting married. It's the fact that we're sitting like quite near the back going, excuse me, do you know that I'm the star of this life?
Oh, you don't want a speech from me? Oh,
yeah.
Oh, that's weird. A lot of what I think for me defined the panic years was feeling out of sync with the people around me. And a time when that reared up like a sort of Medusa was at weddings. I often felt like I had just slipped into a slightly different marble run to the people around me. I remember talking to my therapist about this and him saying that there are certain shared rituals, communal sort of celebrations that direct the movement of travel within a group. And weddings are kind of one of them. They're almost a way of signaling to the group, we are now not going to be quite as promiscuous as we have been, or we're not going to enter into relationships quite so quickly and exit them quite so easily. You know, we're now entering a time where there is more expectation and meaning on things. And so, of course, personally, you feel a little bit of that weight.
Well, I never, ever went to anyone's wedding because I think they're shit. And I'm really sorry. I do like discos. I do like buffets, actually. A lot of the stuff, I like churches. Some of it I really like separately. I don't like being bored.
Yeah.
And I don't like having to wait for a buffet. there's lots of reasons. And so, but the brilliant excuse I've had is that I've been gigging constantly for nearly 12 years. And so my best friend, Carrie, I did go to her wedding and I left early to do a gig for £30.
Like, amazing.
It was awful. She doesn't know that, actually. No one tell her. And the only other weddings I went to were my sister's, because obviously I had to go. And so that was the one, in terms of out of her mind, me wanting to write this show that was kind of semi-based on my family. There were three things. One, my mum wore a white dress and it was really, really funny because my mum didn't think that was wrong and I didn't think it was wrong. So I put up an Instagram picture and this row started underneath with people being really rude about my mother. And I really thought, what do you think this is? Like, it was so arbitrary, but it wasn't arbitrary to them. They really thought something intrinsically important had happened when it hadn't. The other thing was like a cliche, and actually I didn't end up putting the line in my show because it sounds too like the thing that doesn't happen, but it did. One of my sister's friends, who's 2 years younger than me, came up to me. Everyone was kind of having a glass of champagne outside, about to go in for a meal. She just gestured around to everyone and went, did you just decide it wasn't for you? And it's like the kind of lines that people put in fiction, because it very quickly sums up what you think everyone is thinking when they look at you. But I didn't actually think that a grown-up adult would say it to me. And the reason, and obviously I've thought about it a lot, that is the reason I've always got away with it, is because my job sometimes involves being on television, and there's a different kind of success. Like, actually, and pretty much all human beings recognize it, whether they've seen you on TV or not. There's this thing that you've done that makes you an outlier in a really great way. I actually have a visible way of like, well, I did this instead, or you can't diminish me, I've got this. The third thing of the wedding is that my mum and dad, who they had a horrible breakup, you know, my mum was 25 when she had three kids, they were so young.
Crikey.
Years and years of him not being allowed in our house. Him and my mum never spoke. He has lived in Australia for 20 years now, so he's been so far away. But my sister's wedding and them having children, they forged a relationship that was so new, not based on the pain that they have caused each other or what they don't have in common. It was a happy ending. The cliche of a wedding was true in that after years and years of not being a functional family, oddly, we looked like a functional family again. And it was so beautiful and so emotionally evolved, because people do really, really hurt each other, especially people who divorce or leave their families and all of that. But what I will say is the thing I have really felt desperate from is people having families, babies. That's the thing that feels entirely separate.
Yeah. At weddings, there is almost like a kind of emblazoning of your status. Like, there's always someone breastfeeding next to a buffet table. There are like toddlers running around. There's someone great with child lumbering up the aisle. And you are looked on or looked at as that woman with like so much approval. It's almost quite claustrophobic, I think. And I always wonder what it's like for a bride if they haven't had a child. There is a real like, see you at the christening.
Every little turnstile you get to, people are asking you about the next turnstile. So on your wedding day, people are asking you about your child. The minute you have a baby, you're literally holding that baby. And people are going, are you going to have another one? It's like, what the, can you just, when will this stop? I know that from friends who've had more difficulty conceiving their second, it can be a really fraught question when someone goes, when are you going to do it then? Because like, what do you want to say to them? And how are you handling that?
In my case, I hated that question because I was desperate to have another baby. And my partner was, he didn't want children in the first place and he definitely didn't want any more. So I was like, how, like, do you want me to actually answer this? Because I can tell you right now, like, I do, and it's breaking my heart that he doesn't. How's your Tuesday going? Like,
yeah, it's incredibly painful. But then I wonder if that is what we want. Do people want to tell us about them? Do they want you to say, I'd love to have another child. It doesn't feel like it's within my control. How about you? And then they could go, I don't feel in control either, actually. Like, maybe they do want to share that. Because people don't talk about the painful, painful bits, whether you've got children or not. It does look like everyone else is just, you know, slipping through it, just ticking boxes. Yeah, I woke up and we were this. And then a year later, we had another one, da, da, da. Yeah.
I used to describe it as like standing on a platform and watching all of my friends and family pulling away on a train that I didn't have a ticket to, and just be like, oh, well, life on the train looks really great. I think I joked once that after I had a baby, I suddenly realised I was on the train and hadn't checked the destination. I didn't actually know where the hell we were going or what was going on. And it was quite frightening. And that can happen in work, and it can happen in housing, and it can happen in relationships too. Like, you desperately look at the other. And then if you change over to that side, you realize that it's as complicated and terrifying, maybe in different ways, because at least you have the kind of social approval of strangers who you bump into in Debenhams. Like, they now approve of what you're doing, but basically fundamentally it's still quite weird.
I think what your analogy makes really clear is actually it's about control, because lots of people don't want to have children. If you're childless on purpose, or definitely not having children right at this point, or don't want biological children now, you feel in control. You don't feel like people are getting on a train without you. You feel really like, I'm where I want to be. It doesn't feel like a platform. And similarly, when you get on a train, when people conceive at the time they want to, and they feel in control, they feel like they're decisions they can make. There must be a greater sense of, I can engineer my life. I think the reason that the COVID year has been so hard is that none of us had any control anymore over anything. And we had believed there were some things we were in charge of. And actually, that's not true. You can't even control like how quickly you can get into Sainsbury's, let alone when and where you work, whether you can pay your mortgage, actually. So stop thinking that that's how life works.
As a very lucky Western white university educated woman, I was sort of raised to believe that if I worked for it, the ethical, moral, political principle was that I could control my life, which it turns out is absolute bollocks from beginning to end.
It's not true. It doesn't matter how privileged you are. In a yoga lesson the other day, all of my wisdom from yoga teachers, the teacher was talking about this year was very difficult because there was lots of effort without effect. And I thought that was such a perfect way of summarising, because there are lots of professions where there's lots of effort without effect, and it makes us feel like failures. We don't ever go, wow, I worked really hard and still didn't get that commission for that article. We don't go, I'm really proud of myself. This is work. This is growth. We just go, oh, failed, really failed. Yeah.
So you never went to anyone's wedding, which I absolutely salute you for. It's like, for me, the slightly more achievable and pleasant version of being a paramedic, that you've got the best excuse. You don't have to go to those things.
Are you saving someone's life? In a way. Is laughter the best medicine? But here's something that's gendered, because I never, ever had problems with my boyfriends when I didn't go to their friends' weddings. So with my ex, who I was with about 4 years, lots of his friends got married when we were together. And if he said, oh, are you free this weekend? I'm going to Bristol. There's a hotel, da, da, da. And I would say, absolutely not. He, one, understood and respected my job and my attachment, how important my job was, and also really respected that I didn't enjoy weddings and it wasn't a fun social engagement for me. And he would go and have a lovely time, and he never felt that people were judging him to be there by himself. He thought, brilliant, I can get super pissed. There's not going to be someone going, can we go home now? I'm tired. Mm. Same with my current husband. He's a couple of times gone back to Australia for weddings. Now, going to Australia would be lovely, but it's a big thing. And when I say, ugh, like, I know they're your best friends, but I like them. It's not that I don't like people. I just don't want to, going back for the wedding, isn't fun for me. Mm. And again, he's never made me feel bad, but I know in other straight relationships, when men don't want to engage socially, it's received as like not being committed to the relationship, as a rejection of those things. It's made to look like you're not serious about that partner. One of my partners, he always says that his ex used to make him really feel bad if he was working and couldn't go to things, because she would say, people ask where you are. Like, and it looks like you're not very into me, and I don't like being at a wedding without my partner. And I think, oh, that's really tricky, because they are huge life events. And if everyone's going, well, your partner doesn't seem to want to hold your hand, does he?
It's really interesting. I think it's one of the reasons that social media has flourished beyond all control, is that we do have a hunger for public witnessing of our private lives in a way that we actually are quite uncomfortable with. A little part of me is slightly annoyed that my partner will never and has never made any kind of public declaration of me, even though he loves me absolutely unconditionally. He's had a child with me. We live together. He's supported me in like innumerable ways.
I think it comes back to the ego again. Insecurity works in odd ways. And sometimes they're tiny, tiny whispers, but they're still there. it's so odd. I have a male friend whose girlfriend complains he doesn't put enough pictures of her on his Instagram. and everyone who's told thinks that that is unreasonable of her. But actually, to her, there's a logic of just going, we're together all the time. Yet if we're near a statue, you take a picture of the statue, not of me and the statue. The thing about compliments is really, I think, a funny thing in relationships, because it can be the worst trait, because wanting to be told you're beautiful then makes you hate yourself. And then having to tell someone to tell you you're beautiful. Like there's no goodness in that. You don't ever feel nourished after forcing someone. Can you please? Do you know that Frida Kahlo quote about find a lover who looks at you like you're magic? Probably most people's lovers do look at them like that.
But they don't look at them like that while holding a phone inches from their face to capture the moment. I genuinely wonder about the couples and partners that will do that, will allow the sort of, like you say, the ego involved in that, that you would happily sit in a restaurant taking endless photos of yourself. Did you ever go to hen do's? And did you have a hen do?
No, I didn't have a hen do. I would say that that's something, again, as a ritual behaviour, I think people should have a long, hard think about where we are in evolution. I understand you might want to see your friends, but do you also want your mum there or your partner's mum?
Do you want to sit at a mock medieval banquet in a conference centre outside Basingstoke with a load of people from someone's work who you don't know, getting not quite drunk enough on strawberry-flavoured vodka? Maybe you do. And in that case, my God, you're going to love hen do's.
Yeah. There's a really interesting study on stag do's, actually, which I mentioned in one of my books because I thought it was so enlightening that this study, they went around separating men from their stag do's to interview them because stag do's are kind of looked to be de-civilizing, like men who behave in a civilized way the rest of their lives suddenly engage in behavior and attitudes that don't seem to be reflective of them. And anyway, what they found out was every single man wasn't having a nice time. He was doing it for the other men. And the pressure of like men, when they become something that feels a little bit tribal, they were all going along with it, thinking that everyone else in the group was having a brilliant time and it was only them who was wrong. I've had to organise two hen do's of two best friends and I really, really resented it.
Do you like really passive-aggressively asking for money on a group WhatsApp chat?
Well, that's what I can't bear. And so here's my terrible trait is that people will go, okay, I've booked a little booth so we can go to karaoke all by ourselves for an hour. So everyone owes me $4.50. And so here's my back details. And I can't, that whole thing of people going, thanks so much for doing that, Mary, $4.50. I just pay for it. And then other people consider that rude. But so I would much rather like, okay, well, I'll just get this then. And I don't want everyone's pound. And people consider that more rude because they think part of the fun
is doing
the back transfers, maybe.
Well, if they find that fun, then they're very welcome to retrain as accountants.
Yeah.
As someone who is only sort of recently financially stable, for years I was like, so hold on, I've just had an email that's come through that's like, hey hens, some weird emoji. So we've just decided that actually maybe what would make it really special for her is if we also got her a gift and a gift to open on the day and a holiday. And we don't think like her family should have to pay. So basically it's going to be about £375 each. Hope that's okay. And it's like, of course it's not. Of course that's not okay. You can't expect us to invest in someone's romantic decisions financially like this at this stage in our life because it's not going to be reciprocated. You know, as someone who hasn't had a wedding, like I could go around and just invoice all those people.
Yeah, if this is how we show love to each other socially, you all owe me £800.
Exactly. Like if that's how we measure the sort of mutual affection and support of our lives, then can you all take me on holiday, please?
I think that's how I got into the habit of not going to weddings is because I couldn't afford to. That actually is a huge factor. People just assuming you can afford a hotel or just assuming you can afford travel or travel for that and for, you know, a hen do.
So can we talk about the fact that you are married?
Well, I didn't have a wedding. So the not wanting weddings thing is very true. We didn't tell anyone, like we didn't put it on Instagram. We didn't do any hints or pictures or anything. And we didn't write any of those posts about how we love each other. And partly that was because of previous relationships. So my husband has been married before. My ex-partner is also now engaged, but just out of kind of sensitivity to everyone involved. And I don't know how we would feel otherwise. I think both of us are a little bit more private, not about everything, but we don't do, you know, big Facebook statements about how we're feeling today. But I spoke about it just as the show was coming out of her mind. I did Graham Norton and it was a really good link into a bit. So I said that I'd got married and then I did this bit. And then a lot of my press interviews kind of focused on it. Uh-huh. And some of my press interviews, I did an interview and then a week later they found out, they saw, and then they want to do an extra bit of the interview about being married. When they did the research call for me to go on the One Show, the first question they asked, they said, so you got married, what does your husband think of your sitcom?
Oh,
and
wow.
I couldn't believe it. I reacted so badly. I would really try never to be rude to any kind of interviewer, especially a researcher who's just been given a piece of paper and has never heard of you. And I was almost like gagging, like not knowing how politely to go, like, is it the 1950s? Do you know what you just said to me? Yeah, it's been a really cliched thing, but a version of that question is now coming up every time I do anything, which reinforces that other people are much more excited about me being married. It means a bigger thing to them than it does to me. It still feels like I've got a boyfriend. It doesn't feel like a different commitment. It doesn't feel like a different kind of life. And maybe that's because if without a wedding, you don't spend months planning it. And then the day, you know, like Christmas is supposed to mean something. Maybe it's that, but other people think it defines me in some way. Or I've had people be quite rude in terms of that. I just didn't think you'd do that. And it's like, well, you still think it's a thing, don't you? You still, it's really, yeah, it means something. We aren't allowed to decide what it means for us. It's imposed.
That's really interesting. There are moments where a subscribed set of sort of behaviours rear up, however enlightened you think you are and however enlightened you think your peers are, they're just going to come up. It hasn't changed anything. I feel exactly the same, which I think is a lovely thing to put in your next anniversary card, by the way. The dad character in Out of Her Mind, I think, is something I just want to talk to you about. My dad had a hernia operation, and when he got home, 4 hours after being discharged, I got a very panicked phone call, and he answered the door completely white-faced, and he said, "My willy looks like an aubergine. It's gone dark purple and it's all lumpy and weird." And I was like, I'm not a doctor or nurse. I don't really know what to say about this. You don't want to look at it, do you? And I was like, absolutely not. Call 111. He was like, I don't know if it's getting better or worse. I need to take a photo of it. And I was like, okay, take a photo of it. And he said, do you want me to go in the bathroom to take a photo of it? And I said, yes. Yes, I do. So he went into the bathroom, and after a lot of sort of shuffling, this very plaintive, he was like, "Neil, can you come and take the photo?" I was like, oh my God. So I looked down at this like shock, Einstein shock of white pubes, and then what genuinely looked like a sort of revolting genital aubergine. And I think at that moment I was like, being given away by this man, like that's a strange idea, isn't it? That we have a kind of relationship that is in any way a prototype for how I'm going to interact with men for the rest of my life. Like what a weird thing that is. But I think a lot of in the book, as a woman, I really felt like until I'd fixed my relationship with my dad, I'd never find a happy relationship with men. And I was sexually attracted to men, so that was something, and romantically attracted to men, so that was something I needed to get fixed. You have this wonderful thing in Out of Her Mind where you leave the dad as this very frustrating, ambiguous, enigmatic character. And you do say about the brother-in-law character, of course he's perfect. He's written by a woman. I've written him. And I thought, and that's why the dad is so brilliant, because it's written by a woman who knows that relationship with dads.
With my dad, my real life dad, I didn't ever think I needed to sort the relationship out, because then I would have more functioning, like, romantic relationships. But I did know it was on me, I think. And I think that's quite common for, you know, and we don't know it's going to be part of adulthood. There comes a point, for me, it was early 20s after university, we go, okay, if this is going to become functional, they don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
It's going to have to be driven by, yeah, the children.
Yeah.
Then have to go, oh, I'm not okay with this. I need to love you. The way I described it, it's like I felt like I was carrying around love. And because there wasn't a clear passage to like give it to him, it was burdensome. I needed to be able to love him and think lots of brilliant things about him. And now I do.
Yeah.
But it did need to be smooth. I think that story about your dad, and I know it's probably an awful thing having to look at your dad's aubergine penis, but it does reek of intimacy and trust.
Yeah.
It's so lovely to be in a family that isn't, like, you know, post-World War suppressed, kind of, like, they actually love each other, and that's a very ugly form of love, but it is love.
It's as ugly as it gets. I can also see now that he sees me as someone who has a son and I have a partner. I've obviously come into contact with Willy's. I'm not young. He's not protecting me from the world. I'm in the world now, and so is he, and so we have to meet each other as equals. The final thing I wanted to ask you, because it's also something that has sort of haunted my thoughts, is the first time I watched one of my friends get married, I felt just a palpable, overwhelming sense of loss, that I was losing her. I was losing her to a man. I was losing her to an institution, a version of the future. It was like I was watching her in front of my eyes become a different person. Did you, as someone who now is married and your priorities are different, how have you weathered or navigated that relationship with your friends?
So my priorities aren't different, actually.
Lovely.
Yeah, I don't know. I honestly don't know where they would be. I think the people, when we do feel that about people, just that sense of loss, it's because they have changed. And also sometimes, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, they have to, especially if people who have children, of course your energy goes in a different direction. Of course you're much more likely to want to socialize with people who understand your situation, who can, your children can play together. So that's one thing. Like, no one would ever invite really a childless woman to come with them to like the playground. You invite other people who've got children and those kind of things. Lots of my friends got married and it didn't change anything about our relationship whatsoever. And I would really hope that that would be true of me. Like, I would never make a choice to hang out with my husband, especially after being stuck with him in a flat all of this year. But absolutely desperate to meet new people, any people, just talk to people on the bus. So, new people are my priority now, and I'm really invested in all of my existing friendships.
It's a very reassuring thing to hear, actually, that you're, even though to the outside it looks like someone is going away to a sort of planet-marked commitment, actually that commitment can just enrich the life that they already had, if it's good.
Yes. Well, it has to enrich, because two people is so few. Like, you need so many people in your life. There are so many conversations you need to have, and you can't have them all with one person. You can't keep growing. And also, I'm a big believer in that missing someone is the best part of a relationship. Like, the gaps. I love it when my husband goes away to Australia, because while it's very far, it's such a wonderful reset and reminder of how we feel about each other and what we do for each other's lives and all those kind of things. And really love missing him. Love the gaps. And yeah, he's now another person in my social life. I don't have one anymore.
He's not a replacement for your social life.
Oh God, he couldn't be. Like, but no one could. It would be so unfair.
Even your dog is not a replacement for a social life.
Yeah. Well, a dog is a good comparative, is that when you get a dog, no one goes, like, oh, I'll never see you anymore. And you're like, no, I've met the love of my life. He's my best friend. And sometimes he'll be there and we could just watch him running around and it'll be great. Just like a husband. Yeah.
Oh, wasn't she incredible? I wish I'd married her myself. As Sarah and I touched on, weddings can bring up a huge amount of social anxiety for lots of people. So I wanted to speak to an expert to unpick why and what we can do to cope. The psychologist, Dr. Emma Hepburn, is the best-selling author of A Toolkit for Modern Life, 53 Ways to Look After Your Mind. She also works in the NHS and has a frankly enormous following on Instagram, where you can find her as The Psychology Mum. I started by asking Emma just what's going on in our brains when we go to a wedding.
Our brains are designed to pick up on what other people are thinking. Now, if you're in a safe situation, which I would say with people who you know very, very well, you can kind of predict what they're thinking. We're pretty certain that we know how they will react, and therefore we know how we can react to them. We're also pretty certain that they think, well, usually quite highly of us. So our brain is constantly predicting, so we know what to do in response. There's also, it's thought to be a kind of evolutionary thing that we have a tendency to care about what people think and also to seek approval. So when we're going to a big group of people, like a wedding, or meeting new people, a party, there are lots and lots of people there, lots of eyes watching us, and lots of brains watching us. That's lots of potential judgments. There's a higher level of anxiety for most people going to these situations, and your body gets you ready for that response. So it will kind of get your energy going. It'll kind of trigger the sympathetic nervous system to get your body ready for action, because it's a slightly more anxiety provoking situation. Now, some people might experience social anxiety in that situation, but also most people experience some degree of this kind of elevated energy levels, which is the same as an anxiety response, really.
So the very thing that can get you on the dance floor or get you carrying a bride through the air on a chair is also the sort of same chemical hormonal response as you would get to having to run away from a wildebeest.
Pretty much. That's a pretty good description. You might get slightly more of it if you saw a wildebeest, or you might get more of it.
I've been to some very hairy weddings.
Well, yes. There's different kind of degrees of that response, but your body will be getting ready in some way and producing energy. And it just depends kind of how much that spikes, really.
That's so interesting. Because we are sort of tribal animals, the approval of the group, which I think we sort of tend to see as a bit clingy, a bit needy, has a really important long evolutionary purpose. And so if you want to be accepted by the bridesmaids, if you want to look nice in the photos, you don't want to say an embarrassing thing to somebody's granny. That's because we're sort of evolved to be accepted by our peers
because it's safe to be otherwise.
And that means that other people's judgments, if the granny thinks your outfit is rubbish or people are thinking that you said the wrong thing, that's a threat. Mm. So that's a potential threat as well. Even if it hasn't happened, the fact you're saying, oh, maybe people won't like my outfit, or maybe I will say the wrong thing, which then triggers off that threat response. Now, if you are worried about that threat, you're going to become really self-aware and self-vigilant. And then you will, of course, notice when you stutter. You'll notice when that energy response starts to make you go slightly red in the chest. It starts rising up and you think, I wish I'd worn a polo neck instead of a V-neck.
So it's self-perpetuating.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. Right. So you're vigilant, you notice it. And then, of course, that'll make that threat response go greater as well.
This makes me honestly feel so much better about the way I've behaved at so many weddings. And also, you know, because I am the product of a marriage that didn't work out, and I have sort of, I think I carry psychologically a sense of cynicism, mm-hmm. maybe, about weddings. You know, I think that if you are someone who maybe isn't from a religious background, or you would have chosen not to get married yourself, going into that kind of situation, the level of judgment will feel even more acute, perhaps.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, how do we make sense of the world? We think about our brain, it's encased in a skull. It doesn't really see much except for what comes into it through your eyes. And we make sense of that. So your brain is making sense of every situation through what it's seen before. Mm-hmm. So if you've previous experience of weddings, or you have beliefs about weddings, as soon as you go into a wedding, your brain is going to understand it according to that information. And even if you're saying, oh, this is nice, isn't this lovely, your brain will still be going, yeah, but remember what happened last time. I'm making sense of this wedding with whatever happened before.
Of course. That's so brilliant. You've picked it apart so fantastically. Do you have any advice on things we can do mentally, physically, socially, that will make us sort of more comfortable in that kind of situation?
I guess there's a few things you can do. The first thing is, you know, it's okay to be a bit anxious in that situation. If you start saying, I should be the life and the soul of the party, I shouldn't be feeling anxious, I should be feeling great, it's a wedding, why on earth am I feeling slightly anxious? You start to criticise and shame yourself, which of course is more threat, which makes you more anxious. So actually just saying, it's okay to feel a little bit anxious going into the situation. It doesn't actually matter if, for example, I stutter in a conversation. Probably people, A, don't care. B, probably won't notice, because they're all probably thinking of their stuttering or focusing on themselves. And also, even if they do notice, actually making mistakes probably just makes you more human, and people quite like that.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great way to sort of build an intimacy. If you are the one who slips over on a profiterole and lands in someone's lap, like, you're much more likely to build up a meaningful friendship with the people around you than if you hold it together in a sort of poised and icy way for the whole day.
Although, obviously, next time you see profiteroles, you'll probably hate them.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, you'll carry that around. No shoe pastry for you, thank you. But you're quite right. Something that I almost have to tell myself in any social situation is that I am not the centre of that social situation.
Absolutely.
At a wedding, unless you are the couple who are getting married, no one is that bothered about what you do.
And people just don't remember most things. It's not going to be part of their brain in even 5 or 10 minutes. And that's the case for most things. The other thing is, you know, these situations are cognitively overloading. There's so much going on. There's so many brains are looking at you. There's just so much kind of stuff coming at you. It's cognitively overloading. And how I cope is I pretend I need the toilet a lot more frequently in weddings or at social occasions. And I nip to the toilet for a little break just to get my brain kind of coming down a little bit. It's just getting away from that stimulation.
One wedding where I felt more at ease was one where I'd cycled there. So I knew that when I wanted to, I could leave. But I know, sort of, when it comes to anxiety, the escape route is something that can be as sort of harmful as it can be helpful.
There's two ways to look at this. There's avoidance, where people don't do things because they're anxious, and how that maintains anxiety is often we leave the situation when we're at our most anxious. Mm-hmm. So we never learn that it's kind of as terrible as we think it is, or that our anxiety will come down. But there's another part, which is safety behaviours. So people might kind of maintain their anxiety and never kind of get in a situation by maybe hanging at the back of the room, you know, never looking at a person, looking down the entire time. But actually, again, it's avoidance, and it doesn't kind of keep the behaviour going. And that can be unhelpful with anxiety, because you kind of never kind of break through that anxiety barrier and kind of learn actually it's not as bad as your brain's predicting. Mm-hmm. However, I'd say it's not always unhelpful what you're describing, because that's probably enabled you to go into the situation because you feel in control. And weddings can feel very out of control. So when you had that bike there, did you stay in the wedding?
Yes, I did. Yeah. Yeah.
So actually, is that unhelpful? Because it made you feel in control and it made you feel able to stay in a situation that's potentially anxious or anxiety provoking. So there's probably nothing wrong with that.
You know, right about the avoidance, that if you leave at the peak of your sort of anxious feelings, you don't learn the de-escalation and you will probably carry then to the next social occasion, the next wedding, that heightened state of worry. Whereas if you just can hang in for a little bit longer, everyone moves on, the band starts playing again, the profiteroles get swept up, and then you will realise that things are not as catastrophic as they might have felt 20 seconds earlier.
And what we remember is the last and the first thing. So if that's the last thing that happened to you, you were highly anxious and you left the wedding, that'll stick with you. So if you can continue on and then you get a really positive part after that, when you've had a really good chat, that's no longer the most recent event. So you're giving yourself more chance of remembering something positive or something that's not that heightened anxiety afterwards.
I mean, you can really see why you're award winning, because this is incredible. I want to bring you along to everything I go to now. This has been so helpful. Hello, you. Thank you for listening. It's lovely to have you back. I hope you found that as useful as I did. Thank you so much to Sarah and Emma for such brilliant conversations. And thank you to all of you for listening right to the end. I'm now going to ask you to do me a huge favour. It's free, but it makes a massive difference. If you could please subscribe to the podcast wherever you found it and leave a glowing 5-star review. It'll help more people find it. It'll make me happy. It'll make my producer happy. It'll make everybody happy. Our guest next week is the phenomenal, the beautiful, the brilliant Nikesh Shukla. So I'll see you there next week.
This is a brand new audio production.